Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Was Ronald Reagan a Republican in name only? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Today's Republican Party wants to purge any member who favors increasing taxes or the size of government, often in the name of Ronald Reagan. But Reagan raised taxes big time in Washington and Sacramento, and the bureaucracies were bigger after he served both as president and as governor. Could he win a Republican primary today? On this day after Reagan's birthday, we'll hear from the GOP, past and present. Also tonight, Democrat Jane Harman is resigning from Congress, and Texas has a bigger budget shortfall than California. Later on, the stalemate continues in Egypt. First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Egypt's new vice president claims he has reached a consensus with demonstrators, but they still insist there's no compromise till Hosni Mubarak steps down. We'll hear more tonight. First, LA Democrat Jane Harman plans to resign from Congress to take over the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. That means a special election in the 36th congressional district stretching from the LA Harbor to Marina del Rey. Alan Hoffenblum edits the Target Book, which both parties call the last word on legislative and congressional politics. Good, as always, to have you on our program.
Oh, always good to talk to you, Warren.
Already we have Janice Hahn, Los Angeles City Councilwoman, declaring for this race. Who else?
Well, I understand that Deborah Bowen, our Secretary of State, is looking at the race.
Very, very seriously, according to her PR people.
Well, it's very credible. You got to remember, for 8 years, she represented a state Senate district that encompassed much of that area, and for 6 years, she was a state assemblywoman from that area. So she's represented that district extensively. And then there's always Mary Winograd, by the way.
Marcy Winograd.
Marcy, thank you. You know, a progressive Democrat who twice ran against Jane Harman in a Democratic primary in 2006 and just this past year in 2010. So I really do expect a very large group of Democrats. I don't think anyone's going to have the ability to clear what we call clear the field.
When Jane Harman resigned once to run for governor before she came back to stand for re-election, there was a Republican in that seat. Is it a possibility that there might be a Republican challenge?
I don't think so. First of all, the district was very, very different then. That was Steve Kuykendall, who at the time was a Palos Verdes councilman. He has since moved to Long Beach. He's lived in Long Beach for the past 20 years, so he's well outside the district. But no, this is a very solid Democratic district. The registration is like 45% Democratic to 28% Republican, with a very large decline to state independent voters at 22. I mean, this is a district where the independent vote is almost as large as the Republican vote. And what's also going to be interesting, Warren, this race is going to be under the new open primary, top two candidates, in which if no candidate receives a majority of the vote cast, then the two top vote getters, regardless of party, will run against each other in the runoff. So this could be the first race in which we see two Democrats run against each other, allowing Republican and independent voters to determine which of the two Democrats they would prefer to see elected to Congress.
If that would happen, to what extent might Israel become an issue?
I think Israel, regardless, is going to be quite an issue. I don't care how many Democrats run, when you're dealing with the environment, when you're dealing with the health care plan, and most of the major issues, they're all going to pretty much agree. Maybe on health care, some are going to want a single payer and want to go even further than Barack Obama, but none of them are going to advocate repeal. But I think what the issue might be, which is what it was between Marcy Winograd and Jane Harman, was on national security issues, because they were very unhappy with Jane Harman and her position on the Patriot Act, her strong support in the war in Afghanistan, and what have you. So there's a position that the progressive Democrats have on foreign politics that is very different than the mainline, liberal Democrats on the West Side. So I could very well see that that could become a major issue among the Democrats in that race.
And it was Israel itself was an issue between Harman and Winograd. Explain how that worked.
Well, that was basically it. I mean, Marcia Winograd, who herself is Jewish, by the way, they were both. So there wasn't any anti-Jewish element, but the Winograd comes from a faction that strongly disagrees with the current policies of the state of Israel and strongly you know, support, you know, I would say, come, you know, positions like Ron Paul and, you know, Kucinich and others have on the area of foreign policy, where you have a large segment, particularly the current congressmen who represent much of the West Side, such as Henry Waxman and Howard Berman and Brad Sherman, who have a much more different outlook as to what is in the best interest of American foreign policy. So I can see that being an issue. I mean, the West Side has a very large group of very active progressive Democrats who I've seen in the past are just frustrated that they don't have their own, you know, Nancy Pelosi or Lynn Woolsey, you know, real tie-in-the-blue Democrat representing their area. And I think you could see a very strong ideological battle. But unlike the old days and before the open primary, where usually the most liberal won the primary, then went on to a perfunctory campaign against a nominal Republican, this time we may see two Democrats running who have different opinions, and it'll be the independent and Republicans determining which of the two actually are successful.
You call it a West Side district, but it only begins at Marina del Rey, then goes down to the harbor, and it's got some interior cities, does it not, that would make it more conservative. Plus, it's got a lot of defense spending and aerospace.
The reason I mentioned that, first of all, it actually goes up to Mar Vista and Venice, surrounding the, you know, the city.
Okay, all the way to Venice. Okay.
That's right. And that's what's interesting about the district. You got the Venice and Mar Vista area. That's for the hotbed, you know, attached to West L.A., where you get most of the progressive Democrats. Then it goes through the Marina. Then it goes through El Segundo. Then in the South Bay area, Torrance and Manhattan Beach and Hermosa Beach, which tend to be where most of the moderate Democrats are. They tend to be more pro-business. Then it ends up down in the harbor of San Pedro, which is where Janice Hahn is the representative on the L.A. City Council. So there's really three areas within that congressional district. As I said, you get the Mar Vista, Venice area, the South Bay, Torrance, Beach Cities, and then the harbor area. And I would be surprised if you don't have candidates coming from all of those areas. Now, Deborah Bowen herself is from Marina del Rey, and I really don't know what her politics is on foreign policy issues. I don't know if many people do. And so it'll be interesting. And, of course, Janice Hahn comes from San Pedro.
Okay. Again, Alan Hoffenblum, formerly director of the California Republican Party, now still a Republican consultant and publisher of the California Target book. Again, both parties regarded as the last word on congressional districts. Thanks a lot, as always.
My pleasure, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Yesterday was the 100th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's birth. And at a celebration in Santa Barbara this weekend, Sarah Palin said it's time to get back to his principles of low taxes and small government. It's true that Reagan did famously say the most terrifying nine words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." But as governor and as president, Reagan both raised taxes and increased government. Ray McNally is part of McNally Temple Associates, Republican consulting firm in Sacramento. Ray McNally, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be on. Thank you.
Do you think that the far right has hijacked Ronald Reagan's image?
Yes. The image of Ronald Reagan invoked at today's California Republican Party conventions is very different from the Ronald Reagan who served as governor, who served as president. Very different.
What's the difference between the image and the reality?
Well, he drew a distinction between being a conservative, which he certainly was, and being a radical conservative. And he knew the art of compromise. He knew how to run government. And he knew his first responsibility was to make government work and not to shut it down. And like you say, he raised taxes. He supported gun control. He granted amnesty to 3 million immigrants who had come to the United States illegally. He increased welfare benefits. And he would be hard-pressed, honestly, to win a Republican primary in California today.
Even as a president, even in his latter days?
Well, no, I mean, with a record like that, I would expect somebody like a Grover Norquist to be in California and railing against the fact that he raised taxes or he expanded welfare. He'd be branded a rhino, a Republican in name only.
Ray McNally again, Republican consultant in Sacramento. John Fleischman is founder and publisher of The Flash Report. That's a leading California conservative political website. And he is vice chair in the South of the California Republican Party. Good to have you, as always.
Great to be on, and always great to hear from Ray, who's a friend who lives up in Sacramento, so I don't get to see him very often.
What do you think about what he said, that governor and president Ronald Reagan wouldn't be able to win a Republican primary in California?
Well, you know, this goes to a core issue I talked with Ed Meese about not too long ago. And for listeners who don't know, Ed Meese was a core advisor to Ronald Reagan and served as Reagan's attorney general both in California and in Washington, D.C. And what Meese said to me was instructive. He said, look, if Ronald Reagan were around today, he would be a part of the Tea Party. If Ronald Reagan were around today, things have gotten so out of hand that Reagan would have moved more to the right. And it's nice to talk about what Reagan did back in the 80s, back in the 70s, back in the 60s. But the question is, what would he be instructing us to do today about trillions of dollars of debt? What would he say about how to respond to a state budget that was, you know, due to massive overspending? And, of course, people don't talk about the fact the reason he raised taxes as governor of California is, you know, he came in after on the heels of a Brown who spent most of California's annual budget in the first half of the fiscal year before he came in. The state was broke, and he spent the rest of his administration lowering taxes to try to make it back up to the people. So at the end of the day, if we're talking about Reagan's legacy, I think the legacy that Reagan we want to harken back to is somebody who was able to bring an optimistic, positive message to the Republican Party, but stand firm on the core principles he believed in. That's what we need more of.
State isn't just broke right now. It is. There's a $25 billion shortfall. Ray McNally, it's admittedly easier to say what he did than what he might have done if he were here now. But what do you say to that? What about the crisis we're facing in Sacramento? What do you think Ronald Reagan would do about it?
Well, first, the genius of Ronald Reagan is he surrounded himself with people of different views, not only in Ed Meese, but Jim Baker, for example. And he, like I say, he was a pragmatist who fixed problems and made government work. What I think he'd do today, I think you look to history and he would take the steps needed to solve the problem.
Will that mean raising taxes?
But probably. Somehow increasing revenue. He certainly would be doing everything possible to cut spending. But, you know, I think he would, in fact, say, hey, look, we need to raise more revenue to fix this problem, and by God, we're going to fix it. And when we do, like I did in the past, we're going to fund tax reform, and we're going to make sure people get their money back.
Was he able to get the money back?
Yeah, in some regard, he helped fund property tax relief, that type of thing.
In Sacramento?
Yes.
Okay. John Fleischman, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, if I were Ronald Reagan, the first thing he would say is, if he could have a conversation with Jerry Brown, he would say, well, let me get this straight. You want to raise taxes on the people, but you don't want to change anything about the system so that it won't happen again. And I don't think Ronald Reagan would support what Jerry Brown wants to do, which is ask people to support the largest tax increase in the history of California with no structural reform to make sure that the liberals in Sacramento can't create the same problem again in a few years. There's no guarantee that a five-year temporary tax increase wouldn't be like the last one and would roll on again. And so I think that at the end of the day, we could turkey shoot what the Gipper would or wouldn't do. But I do want to take the opportunity to celebrate the fact the one thing we're not doing is we're not dealing with a Cold War in the Soviet Union, and we're dealing with a president who accomplished some amazing things in his time in office.
Ray McNally, I don't think you said that Reagan necessarily would support what Governor Brown is doing, would you?
No. But I do agree with John in that I think he would insist on some structural reforms to ensure the problem didn't happen again, and he would insist on some deep spending cuts. But like I say, I think he'd certainly consider increased revenue, even if temporarily, to fix the problem. Because, like I said, he understood government needs to work, and that means, you know, reaching across the aisle, building bridges, and compromising when necessary to get, you know, 75% or 80% of what you want.
And he did preside over what's still the largest tax increase in California. Is that correct, or was that Pete Wilson?
That was Ronald Reagan, I believe.
I think it was Ronald Reagan. And you mentioned welfare.
Yes. Now here's a case in point that John brought up. He helped tighten the requirements for welfare, but at the same time, he increased welfare benefits for whom he said were truly needy, recipients, and he set up a system where they would get automatic cost of living raises.
And he was in favor of gun control.
Yes, and he opposed term limits.
And he was in favor, as president, of amnesty for illegal immigration.
He granted amnesty to about 3 million immigrants.
So, John Fleischman, if you just take those things, which he did as the governor and as the president, once again, the question is, would he, if his name wasn't Ronald Reagan, be able to win a primary in California or anywhere else in the country?
Well, I mean, I guess the question would be, if Ronald Reagan were to say, I want to do all those things again, then, you know, he could have a problem. I'd have a tough time supporting somebody who would, at this stage, grant amnesty to everybody who's in the country criminally when there's no end game. That would just be a huge magnet to attract more people. But I think the fundamental core point is we're playing the what would Ronald Reagan do now game. Is it is unfathomable to believe that the events of the last decade and a half would not have fundamentally changed the perspective of where Ronald Reagan is coming from. He would see how ultimately his amnesty program ended up being a failure. We wouldn't have to draw that conclusion for him. Again, I submit that the Ronald Reagan of today would be significantly less bipartisan than the Reagan of yesterday, at least relative to working toward with liberal Democrats in the legislature. I think he would still enjoy bipartisan support from the people.
Why is all of the reality that we have talked about today, raising taxes, gun control, amnesty, welfare, and all of that, forgotten, John Fleischman, when people celebrate his 100th anniversary?
Well, I mean, I think that you have to remember Ronald Reagan was the great communicator. He brought people hope. He brought people excitement. He made people proud to be an American. He was the president who campaigned in flag factories. He was the president who held up little kids. And more importantly, and not to be understood, this is the president who took down international communism, not a small feat and not a small endeavor. And, you know, if you close your eyes and imagine Ronald Reagan, I imagine him in Reykjavik standing there in that big white overcoat facing off against Gorbachev in his black overcoat and ultimately finally winning that battle and watching the Soviet Union dissipate. Those are big picture items that are going to make someone a hero forever.
So, Ray McNally, would you say then that Ronald Reagan has become an image that it can pretty much be used for what it is that people need to advocate? Is that more important, do you think, as has it become more important than the reality of his record?
Well, I think the big lesson that we Republicans should remember about Ronald Reagan is he was inclusive. He reached out to other people. He invited America to join him, and the people of America did in huge numbers. They also joined the Republican Party, and I think the true test today is, do we have the kind of robust leading Republican Party here in California that we did under Ronald Reagan? The answer is no. And I think as a party, we should do some very serious soul searching and see if we shouldn't become a little more Reagan-esque in terms of reaching out and growing the party instead of shrinking it.
John Fleischman, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time left, but what's your response to that? You're an official of the party.
I am an official of the party, and I certainly believe in a message of inclusion. But the challenge that we face today is a massive growth in the size and scope of federal and state spending. And we need to figure out how do you reach out to include more people without offering them government programs and government assistance to do it. And if we can come up with a consistent message in those themes, we should definitely grow as a party.
So, Ray McNally, you're saying that this goal is impossible, or that the party is going to shrink if leaders like John Fleischman don't change their tune?
No. I'm just saying that we need to, as a party, be seen more tolerant and inclusive. Rightly or wrongly, we're more and more being seen as a party that, you know, stiff arms one group or another, where they are not welcome, and that's a mistake.
Okay. Ray McNally, again, a partner in McNally Temple Associates, Republican consulting firm in Sacramento. John Fleischman, founder, publisher of Flash Report, and vice chair south of the California Republican Party. Thanks to you both.
Our pleasure.
Republicans of different colors. Back in a moment with Which Way L.A.?
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla.
CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're just talking about California's continuing budget shortfalls. They have been the subjects of derision for Rick Perry, the governor of Texas. In last year's reelection campaign, Perry sneered at fellow Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger. He bragged about hunting trips to California, persuading companies to come share the business-friendly Texas miracle. But last week, Perry wasn't answering any questions. Turns out that Texas now has a $27 billion gap between taxes and spending. California's is just $25 billion. Wayne Slater covers the State House in Austin for the Dallas Morning News. Wayne, always good to talk with you.
Always good to talk with you.
I take it they won't even use the word shortfall in Texas.
It's a slight bump in the road. $27 billion here, $27 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about big money.
Yeah. So Rick Perry says he's going to take care of that with nothing but cuts?
Yeah, he is. And that's really kind of a distinction between what I see here in Austin and what I have read about in California. Jerry Brown may or may not be successful in his sort of split the baby approach, which includes cuts and extending tax increase, tax increases. But here in Texas, the governor of Texas and, frankly, the lieutenant governor who presides over the Senate said, we're going to do this completely with cuts, no new revenue.
Is there going to be any Texas miracle left, even if California companies want to go there?
As you can imagine, in the last couple of weeks during this legislative session, the hearings have begun, and there is a lot of consternation, a lot of gnashing of teeth by various groups representing the poor, the elderly, schools, higher education, all of whom are warning exactly the same thing. If you do this the way you say you're going to do this, there won't be much left.
Even though there is a $9 billion rainy day fund.
That's right. That's money basically from oil and gas industry. It's there for a rainy day. The governor has not committed himself, though he's indicated he does not want to tap into that. Others say, look, if it's not raining now in Texas, when is it ever going to rain? My guess is that they will tap at least half of that money as part of a budget plan before it's all over.
Did any of this, or is this really such a surprise? I understand there was no issue involving this during the reelection campaign last year.
That's right. You're exactly right. It's not a surprise in the sense that Texans knew and were warned, and we wrote, frankly, Warren, we wrote about a potential budget catastrophe on the horizon. But Rick Perry would just assure people, nope, let's talk about that after the election is over. We're going to be fine. And then he said something that was very important for the constituency that was most important to him, conservative Republican and conservative independent voters. He said, no new taxes. He said that all last year. And so that's really where the conversation began and ended on the campaign trail. Now they've got to deal with the particulars.
What can you say about the evidence being produced by the advocates of the poor, the elderly, the schools, higher education, and all the rest? Are they really painting an accurate picture when they paint such a disastrous one?
Well, I think they're painting a picture that's accurate if, in fact, the legislature were to do what they would have to do if they followed the injunction of the governor and the lieutenant governor. I think ultimately, though, what's going to happen is there will be sources of revenue found, not taxes, because taxes are verboten here, but it will be revenue. Certain kinds of revenue sources will come, so I don't think the hit will be that bad. Having said that, I don't see that there's any way that we're going to avoid some cuts to higher education, which means a layoff of teachers, higher tuition, less money for college grants, and less money for some of the least of us here in Texas.
You mentioned the rainy day fund at $9 billion. You said maybe half of that would be a source of revenue. What are some of the other possible sources?
Well, some of the possibilities are some various fees, the user fees, and for example, cities right now, some companies right now get a certain tax breaks, get a certain break for collecting the state sales tax. Well, that could go away. There could be some smoke and mirrors approach. I know that Governor Brown has talked about no more smoke and mirrors. We've done that. We still may have an opportunity to do that kind of thing. And fundamentally, there is a business tax that we created here in Texas a few years ago to balance a property tax decrease. We cut property taxes and then created this business tax. It was supposed to be even Steven. In fact, the business tax has not brought in the amount of money that it was supposed to, which is part of our problem right now. an effort to amend that business tax and bring in the amount that people say it originally was supposed to will be underway. Now, whether it succeeds or not depends on basically the new Tea Party-related candidates in the legislature and Grover Norquist, the famous tax cutter in Washington. If he doesn't send his signal of approval from Washington about what we're doing here, then people like Rick Perry, who are looking out a national, at least national attention, and the lieutenant governor who wants to follow Kay Bailey Hutchison as senator, may just fall right in line with the Grover Norquist crowd.
Do you think they'll keep sneering at California?
I think it's harder. It's harder to sneer at California now. In fact, I have to say this. Governor Perry said something nice about Jerry Brown the other day.
Wow.
He said basically that Jerry Brown's a serious person who faces a serious difficulty, and I like the way he thinks. I think that's part of an effort by Rick. Oh, I know. It's part of an effort by Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, now the Republican Governor Association chairman, to try to recruit Jerry Brown and other Democratic governors to put together a unified front to Washington saying, can we have more flexibility in Medicaid and in other program restrictions?
Okay. Some interesting potential stories coming up. Wayne Slater, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for being with us today.
Great. Great to be with you.
Bye-bye. Senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. We'll be back in a moment. The stalemate continues in Egypt on Which Way L.A.? Werman Olney back with Which Way L.A.? During yesterday's Super Bowl, President Obama gave Fox News his latest assessment of events in Egypt.
I think that the Muslim Brotherhood is one faction in Egypt. They don't have majority support in Egypt. They are well organized, and there are strains of their ideology that are anti-U.S. What I want is a representative government in Egypt, and I have confidence that if Egypt moves in an orderly transition process, that we'll have a government in Egypt that we can work with together as a partner.
President Obama yesterday on Fox News. In parts of Cairo today, banks opened, shops were staffed. At its first meeting, President Mubarak's new cabinet offered government workers a raise. But Tahrir Square is still filled with demonstrators, and they are surrounded by soldiers. David Kirkpatrick is Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times. I know you're on deadline. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about what's going on, what the relationship is now between the protesters and the soldiers.
It's not a question with a short answer. The soldiers seem warm to the protesters. They've always seemed warm to the protesters. But that turned out to be deceiving because then last week when President Mubarak sicked an army of thugs to attack the protesters, the army stood by and did nothing. So we've been, I go over every day and I scrutinize the tanks and the fellas on the tanks, and the revolutionary graffiti on the tanks and the opposition newspapers they're reading on the tanks. And I try to figure out, are they tightening the noose here or are they defending the protesters? And I don't know. I think army, strangely to me, truly seems to try to be neutral between the people and the president. So if that changes, of course, everything here will change. But for now, it seems like the small group of top officials who stand between Mubarak above them and the army below them are torn between a certain loyalty to their boss and patron and the fact that they either won't or can't get the army to move against the people in the streets. And so they're kind of balancing in a kind of equipoise and hoping to steer things back into stability while Mubarak stays in power, but effective decision making takes one step down to the hands of his vice president.
Were there signs today that the army was trying to move tanks and personnel carriers somewhat closer to where the protesters are to sort of squeeze the circle where they are, reduce the amount of area that they have to occupy?
There may have been a little bit of squeezing in, but I'll tell you, they're occupying a pretty big area, and there sure are a lot of them. And they're setting up tents, they're putting up more banners, they're setting up speakers. And today, for the first time, we saw the kind of flowering of commerce in the square, popcorn vendors and cigarette vendors and fruit stands and so forth. So they're digging in. I mean, the army would like to allow traffic to move a little bit more freely around the capital, so they would like, I think, to move them in a little bit. But there's definitely not any swift effort to eradicate them. I think it's more of a waiting game. You know, I think the government correctly calculates that every day they move away from the big defeats they suffered in the last few days, when their police couldn't beat the demonstrators and when their thugs couldn't beat the demonstrators, the government gets a little bit stronger. They recuperate some of their strength every day they're still standing at this point. So it's incumbent on the protesters to try to find some new way to cripple the state.
A lot of demonstrators, as you indicate, in the square, but a lot more people, obviously, elsewhere in Egypt, people who perhaps want to get back to work. How important is the raise in pay for something like 6 million government workers?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, those workers will definitely be pleased, as would I. But inflation here has been pretty brisk. So this doesn't quite bring them back to where they were a few years ago. And it's only government workers, and pay is only part of the picture. So it doesn't do anything about torture, arbitrary arrest, any of the other things that upset Egyptians. So I don't think it's a panacea on the government's part. But at the same time, you know, the country wants to get back to work. This is a cash economy. People don't have credit cards very much. And we've been in a situation where the banks weren't open, people couldn't go to work, they couldn't get paid, trucks weren't traveling, food was running out in the grocery stores. So that taxes everybody's patience. And so to the extent that the government, which really controls the media, is able to portray that as the fault of the protesters, that's a challenge for the protesters as well.
The Vice President, Omar Suleiman, seems to be the one that Vice President Biden is talking to, that Secretary of State Clinton is talking to, and who they see as the person presiding over some kind of transition once Mubarak's moved aside in some way. How does he look to the protesters? I know he met with some of them, including a couple of members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
He looks like the man they have to deal. I mean, he's got the ball right now. You know, the international community is looking to him. Mubarak has stepped aside. He's the face man. He's conversing with the protesters, and presumably he's conversing with the army too. So everything centers on Suleiman. They don't particularly like the look of Suleiman. They feel like if Mubarak is forced to resign, the impact of that event will give them the leverage they need to get a real Western-style constitutional democracy out of Suleiman. But Suleiman does not instill a lot of confidence in them, and I'm surprised he instills much confidence in the U.S. After all, he was the intelligence chief here. And just this weekend on ABC News, he said that Egypt is not ready for democracy and won't be until it develops a culture of democracy, which makes him an unusual candidate to lead a transition to democracy.
Didn't he also suggest that the protesters in the square really didn't amount to much?
Yeah, he did, and he said that the youth revolt, and that's really what it is. This is a kind of a 1968 kind of a movement. This is a generation of young people who, for the first time, are flexing their muscles and speaking out. He said that youth revolt wasn't really a youth revolt; that those people were sort of influenced or manipulated by others, and part of it was a kind of Islamic current around the Middle East. And if you've been out in the square, you think, what is he talking about? You know, this is really not, it's manifestly not an Islamic movement. For sure, there are Muslims there, and some of those Muslims are even Islamists who would like to see a kind of a society that had a Islamic tone to it. But they're not, by any stretch, a majority of the people in the square. And most political analysts here, including the ones in the Muslim Brotherhood, put the reach of the Brotherhood at something less than 30% of the society. The Brotherhood is now saying that were they, you know, once they've got democracy, they're not going to run a candidate for president, and they'll probably only run candidates for about 30% of the seats in the parliament, which is probably about what they've got a chance to win, because they're, you know, they're strong in some parts of the country, in the Delta, in some of the neighborhoods in Cairo, but not all, and they're quite weak in other parts of the country. So it's that's the sort of state of play.
As we heard the president say at the outset of our program, David Kirkpatrick, again on deadline for the New York Times. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Talk to you later. Bye.
Sharif Mansour is senior program officer at Freedom House. That's an independent watchdog advocating for democracy and human rights, headquartered in Washington. Sharif Mansour, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What do you say to what we have just heard from David Kirkpatrick, particularly about Omar Suleiman and the people, as he put it, between President Mubarak and the rest of the army? What's going on there?
I think he has it right, and I think there is an overwhelming, consensus that Suleiman is only going to be accepted, if any, because of his military connection, not because Mubarak appointed him. And I think the majority of the people look at him as possibly someone who would be part of a broader coalition or a broader government that will include equally important personnel, including public figures like Baradayr, Ayman Noor, or Ahmed Zouil, people who actually have been out of the system and have credible have credibility with the people.
So you're saying then that his influence would have to be moderated in some way?
Absolutely, and I think he has to show a lot to be able to even be part of this transition with other people, including stopping all this nonsense about this is a foreign-led movement and all this conspiracy theory. And actually, he needs, and Mubarak needs, to show some accountability. They need to say to the people that this is our responsibility. What happened over the last 30 years, and especially what happened over the last 2 weeks, happened under our rule, and we are partially, if not fully, responsible for it, and ask for forgiveness. That's the only way the people in the streets are going to start opening up for them.
Has the United States, particularly in the presence of the Vice President and the Secretary of State, picked the wrong man if they're talking to Suleiman, or, as David Kirkpatrick suggested, is he the one you have to deal with now?
Well, the United States are, developing their position as they go. I don't think that's the right strategy. I think it shows a lot of fluctuations, and it hurts their image eventually. I think at this point what they're looking for is not meddling or interfering. I think what they're looking for is basically digging themselves out of the hole. They have been interfering in Egyptian politics, whether they like it or not, to admit, but for 30 years they have been supporting Mubarak. They have been giving a lot of aid, a lot of strategic interest between the Egyptian government and the U.S. government. So what they're looking at right now is to come out of it with the least damage. And what we're seeing is that they are moving in the right direction sometimes, but then there are setbacks. And their position is actually confusing people. Anyone in the ground in Egypt right now is actually not sure what the U.S. is going to say next.
Sharifa Mansour, again, a senior program officer at Freedom House, independent watchdog advocating for democracy and human rights. John Alterman is director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's a member of the policy planning staff at the State Department during the George W. Bush administration. John Alterman, welcome to you.
Good to be back with you, Warren.
Thank you. Tell us what your take is on the administration. Is it fluctuating, as Sharifa Mansour suggests? Does it have an image problem?
I think they're evolving toward a decent policy. I think that they've certainly had some missteps. It's a very difficult situation to keep a hold of, but I think they've been right in A, we can't pick who the candidates are going to be in Egypt. B, we have a wide array of interests. And C, there is a strategic interest we have in a more open and more inclusive politics in Egypt. And I think that the administration's done a very good job keeping its eye on that target, not getting distracted by a whole bunch of bright and shiny things that are coming up before its face.
If, as I think a lot of people suspect, including perhaps Sharif Mansour, I'll ask him about it in a moment, but if, in fact, the military remains in control of the country, is that good for the United States or bad?
I honestly don't think that there's much alternative in the near term. I think what we need to do is find ways to bring more factors into play. I think this has really been more of a military regime than it's been a Mubarak regime for many, many years. Omar Suleiman, as Sharif suggested, is really cut from the same cloth. I've heard Omar Suleiman speak in private about democracy. It's not the kind of thing that warms the cockles of my heart or Sharif's. But the broader issue is that there's a general attitude of the Egyptian military toward democracy, and I think what they really see in many cases is what we're seeing in Tahrir Square is not the flowering of democracy, but a mob. And we have to negotiate some way where there is broader participation, as Sharif rightly said. But I think the odds of sort of immediately transitioning toward a representative system aren't there, in part because you don't have things like reliable voter rolls to transition toward a representative system. You don't have functioning political parties. You don't have platforms. The protesters don't know how they'd work together. There's an awful lot that needs to be done. All that will take some time.
When you say the protesters don't know how to work with each other, according to David de Kirkpatrick and others, there does seem to be extraordinary good feeling on the square itself with Muslims supporting Christians while they observe their religion and vice versa.
That's so wonderful. And on the other hand, I spoke with somebody in Egypt yesterday who is very concerned that the longer this draws out, his feeling is that many of the Islamist groups to the right of the Muslim Brotherhood are asserting more and more influence over conditions on the ground. My understanding is that some of the Muslim Brotherhood members are working security on the entrance to Tahrir Square. I understand that there's a bit of a carnival atmosphere, and today is better, some days are worse. But I am not entirely sanguine that because people feel good that this is all going to turn out well. There are lots of people I have tremendous admiration for. I think anybody who's paying attention all has to be worried about things possibly going in a negative direction.
Okay, John Alterman again at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Earlier we heard President Obama call for an orderly transition. He's indicated that he thinks that should begin now. Here is Secretary of State Clinton speaking over the weekend in Munich.
There are risks with the transition to democracy. It can be chaotic. It can cause short-term instability. Revolutions have overthrown dictators in the name of democracy, only to see the political process hijacked by new autocrats who use violence, deception, and rigged elections to stay in power or to advance an agenda of extremism.
Again, the Secretary of State is speaking in Munich over the weekend. Wayne White is a former deputy director of the State Department's Middle East Intelligence Office. He's now adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. And Wayne White, it's good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
How do you feel when you hear the Secretary of State to say what she just did, given what's going on now in Egypt and the call for democracy by the protesters in the square?
I think between the lines she's talking about the Muslim Brotherhood. That is a major concern in Washington, one that has to be put into context. And she's also leaning back. Fareed talked about, you know, steps backward that the United States takes that confuse the audience. And in that sense, she seems to be nodding toward a very, very controlled transition in which people like Omar Suleiman are going to play a major role. And one thing we have to keep in mind with respect to not only Omar Suleiman, but the Prime Minister, Ahmed Shafiq, who's a former Air Force chief, not to mention the new Deputy Prime Minister, Field Marshal Tantawi, is that the entire group that is at the top are very close Mubarak cronies, all with a military background, and who pretty much represent the exact pieces of the same animal that we've seen over the last 30 years. And this is why the demonstrators in the street are legitimately concerned about whether they're going to see real follow-through on so many of the promises that are being made by the regime, such as in the meeting with the opposition that Omar Suleiman chaired yesterday.
So you're making the critique of the military people making the promises. It almost sounds as if exactly like what the Secretary of State was saying, apparently, about the Muslim Brotherhood. You never know what you're going to get.
Exactly. And this is the problem we have in leaving the military in charge of a transition, although I agree with what everyone else has said largely, and that is that for the moment there doesn't seem to be much of a choice other than Omar Suleiman, and quite frankly, unfortunately for those demonstrators in Tahrir Square, I think the action has moved elsewhere. I think that the Omar Suleiman is playing a very, very firm game, a firmly controlled game in which he's trying to basically undercut the base beneath them, the popular base beneath them, by offering up a lot of very positive sounding reforms in which we have, you know, only an iffy guarantee of follow through, and meanwhile keeping the country out of a state of normalcy, so there is an increased yearning on the part of millions of Egyptians beyond Tahrir Square, many of whom are former demonstrators who are speaking out even now, who need to go back to work, who need to get some money, and who can't have this continue, you know, forever. And so the yearning for normalcy is working against those demonstrators in Tahrir Square. He knows it, and he's trying to offer up enough concessions in order to wait them out and turn around the rest of the country into a state of greater normalcy in which the military junta, essentially, that is going to preside over this so-called transformation can proceed, you know, in a more orderly fashion.
Earlier we heard David Kirkpatrick say it's very difficult for him to figure out exactly where the army is, not the very top members of the army whom we've talked about, but the middle-level people and the troops on the street. What's your take on that? And if, for example, the marchers in the square the people who are in the square did march, did go outside, did do something of that kind, would the army be divided about what to do?
I think so, and that's something that makes Omar Suleiman, Tantawi, the new deputy prime minister and field marshal, and the other military members of the inner circle very, very cautious in this situation. I served with the Egyptian army in a peacekeeping mode as a Sinai field mission officer out in the desert. I lived with them scores of long shifts for 24 hours overnight at their base, and the junior officers that I worked with very much shared the grievances of common society. This is a conscript army, and when you're talking about the privates, the corporals, and also the lieutenants, the captains, the majors, people like that, they don't get paid a lot. They don't benefit a lot from the corruption at the top, and they have families and relatives who have suffered at the hands of this regime, and there could be, if the army is used against the demonstrators, a ripping effect, you know, within the army, where certain elements of it, particularly those that have spent a lot of time amongst the crowds, there was the description of people reading, tank crews reading opposition newspapers, you know, for example, would not be willing to take violent action against them. So this is one of the restraints, you know, that curbs what otherwise might be a more determined inclination on the part of the army to crack down. This is healthy that they have pause, you know, when they think about using the army as an instrument of enforcement. I would like to make a comment, Warren, if you'll allow me, about the Israeli angle.
Sure do.
There's one thing that, one positive role the army will play, I won't even qualify it, should there become pressure, let's say by a future heavily Muslim Brotherhood government or one that has a very heavy element in it, pressuring for abandonment of the peace treaty or whatever, that's where you'll see the military indicate that the civilian government has crossed a red line. The military knows it cannot stand up to the Israeli army at all. One of its greatest achievements was 1973, which gave it its foothold in Sinai and its ability to negotiate Sinai's return. It can't keep Sinai without a peace treaty. If the Israelis take any countermeasures against Egypt, the army cannot handle it. And the army will be the first to tell the Muslim Brotherhood, back off. This is now, you're playing with our equities, And this could be a real obstacle for anyone in Egypt trying to damage that relationship. Could you chill the relationship? Absolutely, I would anticipate it. Other things, yes. But as far as threats of war that you hear and conflict and the border trouble, no. I don't really feel that's a serious possibility.
And very quickly, we've talked about Israel. What are the other reasons, John Alderman, that the United States is so deeply involved with Egypt and why the way this has worked out is so important to this country?
Well, I think there are two principal other issues. One is we transit Egypt either over air or through the Suez Canal. We put about a dozen ships through the Suez Canal every month. The way we do all of our security in the Middle East depends on having the transit of Egypt and the predictable transit of Egypt. If that went away, if it became more unpredictable, we'd have a problem. We also have very deep counterterrorism cooperation with Egypt across a wide range of areas. Wayne knows a lot more about this than I do. If we lost that or if we lost a lot of visibility into that, the broader battle against counterterrorism would be harder.
Quickly, Wayne White, we're out of time, but if you could just summarize as quickly as possible what that means, the counterterrorism cooperation with Egypt, especially in the context of Egypt's human rights record.
It's significant, but one problem we have to realize is the extent to which Egypt has cracked down more ruthlessly than it needed to, particularly against Islamist extremists, actually made Egypt an exporter of terrorism. Supplied cadres for al-Qaeda and other major groups, and so it's sort of a two-edged sword. But I think what John said is spot on, that when we that right now and in recent years that cooperation has been very, very vital, that the Egyptian intelligence service is one of the higher quality Middle East intelligence services and brings in a decent amount of information and is linked into some of the other decent services in the region. We would suffer if we lost that link to the Egyptian node there, with Suleiman having actually functioned as sort of the nexus, you know, of that particular relationship.
Well, that's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of To the Point. Thanks to Wayne White of the Middle East Institute, John Alterman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Sharif Mansour of Freedom House, and David Kirkpatrick, our earlier guest with The New York Times. Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Christian Bordeaux, Francis Anderton, and Katie Cooper, our managing producer, Karen Radziner, technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla, or join the conversation on Which Way L.A.'s Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.